listening to By the Well, a lectionary podcast for preachers to help you preach the good news in your communities. I'm Fran Barber.
And I'm Robin Whittaker. And joining us today on screen, for those of you watching, is Megan Turton, a PhD candidate at Whitley Theological College in the University of Divinity, who happens to be writing an entire PhD on these legal code law narratives. So we're going to pick her brains as we unpack Exodus 20. So our readings for today are Exodus 20, 1 to 20, Matthew 21, 33 to 46. And if you'd like to preach on the Philippians 3 passage, you might like to listen to our podcast we recorded with Sean Winter on Philippians. But Megan, let's ask you, first, give us your fabulous thesis title and what drew you to these, this narrative that's all about law and legal codes.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. So my thesis, I'm afraid, sounds pretty dry. I like to think that it's more interesting, perhaps, than the title suggests. But so I'm writing on the character and extent of legal and narrative variation in the Hebrew manuscripts of Exodus 19 to 24. So overall, I look at the way that the laws are still changing and developing in the actual text of the manuscripts during quite a late period, so leading up into the Second Temple period. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people are quite intrigued as to why someone might be drawn to look at the legal passages, but I actually have a law degree. So my background is I have a law and arts degree, and I obviously studied law, but also the development of ancient Israelite literature, and obviously coming from the Christian tradition, I started to see some really amazing parallels between the interpretive techniques, really, that lawyers use to understand law texts, and also the way that we bring our own interpretive ways of trying to understand some very ancient texts and think, well, how does this apply to us today?
Yeah, and that's the big question.
Yeah. Yes, so we'll start doing that now. I'm wondering, Megan, if we can start having a look at the Exodus 20 passage.
Yeah.
And look where it's coming narratively. What context are we in? Moses has just been up and down the mountain a few times in chapter 19. But, yeah, do you want to flesh out a bit for us what's happening here?
Yes, there's a dizzying kind of I do laugh sometimes every now and then when I'm rereading chapter 19, and I see poor Moses running up and down the mountain about 4 or 5 times and just think, gosh, he must be exhausted.
Yeah. Or very, very fit.
Or very fit, yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we've had the Israelites, they've been redeemed essentially from slavery. They've come out of slavery. They've been wandering in the wilderness, and then they come to, at first it's called the desert of Sinai, and then later it's actually called a mountain. And we have God really offering to enter into this profound covenantal relationship with the Israelite people, and an invitation for them to become a priestly kingdom in the holy nation, which is, you know, you could spend hours unpacking just what that means alone.
Yeah.
And so we have this invitation, but we're not yet sure, well, what does this covenant, this brit in Hebrew, what will this be comprised of? Mm. And so then we are met with this profound theophany, this overwhelming sensory experience of you've got thunder, you've got lightning, you've got smoke. So this is the imagery, the weather imagery of theophany. And then what follows from that are the words of the what we call the Ten Commandments.
Yeah.
This might be a bit premature to bring this in, but in terms of the wider context of the scriptures, listeners will know that there's an account of the Decalogue in Deuteronomy 5.
Yeah.
It's not a theophany in the sense that this one is. I'm just wondering whether you can say a few words about the difference between those two accounts.
Yeah. Well, the Deuteronomy account is really interesting because it's presented as a remembering. So Moses is now on the plains of Moab saying he's retelling the story, at least at the level of the narrative, he's retelling what happened. Mm. But it's very interesting because his retelling actually changes in some details of what actually happened. So the nature of the theophany is adapted a little bit. You've got some fire imagery coming in, and the people's fear is actually further pronounced. Mm. So there's a long kind of extrapolation of how afraid the people were from the voice of God and the fire, and how they then asked Moses to mediate on their behalf. Yeah. So it's like an expansion in its retelling.
Yeah.
And I mean, that mediator word I think is important. Moses is such a mediator in these passages, literally going back and forth between God and the people. Mm.
Exactly.
And we've also had that edict that they can't touch the mountain. So there's something about holy space and fear and awe and
absolutely
separation of spaces, I guess.
Yes. Yeah. There's it's also a bit difficult. There are some very sort of interesting strands in the narrative, because at times, for instance, to repeat the language, we're told that the people, they're told that they're going to be a priestly kingdom and a holy nation. They are told to consecrate themselves, that is to sanctify themselves. Mm-hmm. And at one point in the narrative, they seem to be, at least a select group of people seem to be invited to come up the mountain to participate. But then later on, they are told, no, actually, you cannot touch the mountain. You cannot break through. So it is presented as a bit of a confusing experience. And how what we draw from that, I guess, is the next step. But I mean, it is a theophany. It is God's entry, into the human realm. So from that perspective, it is a profoundly kind of overwhelming, confusing experience in some ways. Yeah.
Can I ask before, but I want to get into the nitty gritty of a couple of them, but before we do, I know, like, if we look at the American context, even today, there are some that want to display the Ten Commandments outside law courts or in Christian schools.
Yeah.
And this is probably the one part of the law that follows, that goes for chapters that Christians kind of know. We believe all the rest. In their context, as much as we can know this, how did they function? I mean, were these actual laws, or were they more aspirational, or were they about identity? How do you think they actually functioned?
Oh, it's such a great question. And once again, you could really write a whole, well, I kind of have written.
Someone should write a PhD on that.
I think the thing is that the word law in itself brings so many images, and in some ways at one moment we think we know what it means, and then as soon as we think about it a little bit more, it has so many more nuances than you would think it does. So people hear law, and if I'm allowed to say, people in the Christian context think about the Jewish law or the Hebrew law, and they can bring certain ideas of what that is. But, I mean, law is fundamentally moral. Law doesn't resonate and doesn't hold normativity unless it connects with our sense of right, of wrong, and what is wrong, of course, things that are prohibited. What is right, what is reasonable, what is just, what is good. So I would say that it is both law and ethics. It is law and it is moral. It is law and it is profoundly religious. The Ten Commandments, you cannot say that law is separate from religion or our concept of the divine and divine justice. And they were definitely ideals, but much of our law is. Even when you have a government that says, in every society there are laws against murder, but it doesn't mean that we don't have any murder. We can clearly see that we do. So there is always an ideal aspect to law, and certainly within ancient Israelite law, we cannot prove or know that each thing was laid down by a judge and, you know, people were taken off to prison. But law is often aspirational because it is normative. It's about what we want to be. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm waxing. Can we talk about the theology here then, the way God is introduced and this emphasis on, well, there's a few emphases. There's the preciousness of God's name in what is maybe the third commandment, depending how you number them.
Yeah.
The prohibition about making images to worship. And then, as you said at the very beginning, this God is identified as this deliverer, the one who's taken them. But it's not monotheism as we understand it, right? There's an acknowledgement that other gods exist. So what's, can we unpack some of those opening statements about God?
Yeah, I would say that the focus, especially once again, there's a little bit of a difference between the Exodus and the Deuteronomy version. The emphasis is far more on worshipping Adonai alone rather than the blanket, well, God, other gods don't exist.
Yeah.
It is a nation choosing to have Yahweh or Adonai as their national god, whatever that means. I know that the word nation brings in some, you know, connotations. So that is the focus, I would say, rather than monotheism.
But there's still, I would say, there's a real radicality there that's lost on hearers now who wouldn't have understood the multiple sort of God, you know, to say I am the Lord your God in the context where there are lots of gods is a huge claim.
Yeah.
And this is the God who has led them to freedom and actually is offering these 10 commandments as a continuation of that freedom, which I would say is a massive preaching point in a culture that thinks that law is about stricture and an assault course to get to freedom. But I'll talk about that later. But I think that verse one, I mean, that is, you couldn't overemphasize the importance of verse one in putting verse 2 to 20 into its proper context.
Yeah.
Their proper context.
Yes, I would completely agree. Mm-hmm. And as I've said before, that the way that law is contextualized by narrative in Torah, it's not something that can be separated from historical contextualization, and it is part of a story. And in this story, it is part of Adonai revealing his identity and his role. So he's already redeemed this people. And I completely agree. And now he's saying, you know, I've already done this. I've already revealed myself to you. And let's go further. War is, at least presented in the narrative, it is a continuation of freedom, of redemption, which is quite a strange thing for some people, but that's how it is presented.
Yeah. And part of that holy nation stuff you mentioned earlier, so God has chosen them, and there's a sense that this covenant, at least as far as I understand it, so correct me if I'm wrong, is now about the people choosing God. People choosing that they will only worship this God whose name has been revealed as Yahweh or Adonai, and that they will not make images of other gods or creatures and worship them in the way that they worship this God. So it's
absolutely
that mutual choosing of a kind of exclusive relationship.
Yeah, that's a really good point. It is, because it's consistently the people are invited to themselves say everything the Lord has spoken, we will do. So it is, it's an invitation, and then it's a reciprocal relationship where the people then ratify, and there's a ratification ceremony in chapter 24 where once again they are, as a whole, as a collective, they hear the word and then they commit to this covenant.
Yeah.
Yeah, and if I could say one more thing about that you made me think of talking about law as freedom, is that the context in the ancient Near East of covenants is, of course, that, I mean, we don't know when these texts were written, but of course, for instance, during when the Assyrian Empire comes in and takes over, we have these covenants being so you've got essentially a vassal nation who has to then be under the vassalage of this empire, and we actually have similar kinds of covenants that show that people were put under this sort of superior power. So we actually have something quite subversive here in the idea that a people, the Israelite people, who during this time may very well have been under the Assyrian Empire, are actually now at the level of the narrative. They're not in a covenant with Assyria. They're in a covenant with Yahweh. Yahweh is the superior power.
Yep.
And once again, that is a sign of freedom, that the law, the true law, the real law, is the one that Adonai gives.
And the summary of that freedom is worshiping this God.
Yes, true.
And so much, as you were saying, you know, there is a radical difference, particularly if we think of those later contexts where these texts are really written down and developed. There is something so profoundly radical about the people actually giving verbal consent.
This
isn't imposed upon them. This is far more invitational and mutual.
Definitely.
And, I mean, all of that stuff you've just named just flies in the face of what is often understood in Christian circles, I think due to bad theology, but often understood that, you know, that these Old Testament laws are so harsh and restrictive this God is some kind of angry God, or, you know, and yet nothing we've said so far suggests any of that.
Definitely.
I did notice the lectionary, and if you're preaching on this, just read the whole 20 verses. The lectionary has chopped it up and left out that stuff about I'm a jealous God, punishing and then rewarding. I think it's because of our discomfort with some of that language. But again, in its context, the rewarding or the blessings for the thousandth generation are so, like, abundantly generous compared to punishments, but again the emphasis is on grace and mercy, not punitive law kind of.
And I did read something recently that suggested that this person believed that the reference to the second and punishment of visiting, you know, iniquity on the second and third generation is probably about considering the lifespan was probably the the generations that would have been in exile during the Babylonian exile, and so that it is possibly thinking through, sort of, once again, it's contextualized, I guess, is what I'm saying, that the idea that punishment will be revisited is them trying to explain, well, why are we still in exile? How long will God, you know, keep us in this position? And the hope is, well, no, we will be returned. We will come back from exile.
I'm wondering, Robin, whether it might be time for us to draw some New Testament connections here that, well, in Matthew's Gospel, Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, he's the fulfillment of this law, the enfleshed one. I'm just wondering whether we have a quick conversation about how to talk about this in a Christian context.
I mean, I think the first thing we should always say is that, you know, particularly in Matthew's Gospel, and there's the year of Matthew, Jesus shows himself not only to be familiar with the law, but to be a lover of the law.
Yeah. Like,
the Torah is his. So, I mean, when we read these stories, we're reading Jesus' stories. You know, there's a deep love and respect that we get from Jesus. And actually, when he expounds the law in Matthew 5, he in some ways sharpens it, not abandons it.
Yeah, yeah.
He makes the moral, ethical principles more demanding, not less, in many cases. So,
yeah, and one who, you know, obeyed the law that he knew so well as a Jewish man, and who went to his death, and God redeemed him, and therefore all of us. And so that's where the grace that we might see in the Decalogue that might not be spoken of by Megan as necessarily there very explicitly. Yeah. But the grace of this God who provides and redeems is here in Exodus.
Yeah. Mm, definitely.
And we see recapitulated.
Yeah.
Christ, for want of a better word. But I'm just saying all that because I'm keen to be specific about the sort of world we're preaching this sort of stuff in. And it's a world where, as we've already mentioned, the law is either considered negative and judgmental and a stricture and a barrier to freedom, or perhaps more prevalently in popular culture, for popular culture and we're formed from that, freedom is freedom of choice in the Western world. So to have this imposed on you, you know, this is a challenge to understand it as freedom and to understand that holiness is putting God first and obeying the Sabbath, remembering that you are not in charge of all the hard work that goes on in creation, that God is.
Yeah.
So they're just some touching points, I think, culturally for our culture that need to be, you know, highlighted and what this passage, how it recasts us.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, the concept of freedom, it is literally in the law, in the Sabbath law of Deuteronomy. You're told to, the reason for the Sabbath giving in Deuteronomy is so that everyone may rest, including I know that the idea that they would even have slaves is rightfully abhorrent to us, but if we remember the context of the times, and then to say that so that your male and female slave may rest as well as you, then it's followed by for you, remember that you yourselves were slaves in Egypt.
Yes.
So the freedom that is given to you is a gift, and the law requires that that freedom be given to others. It is a liberating. Yeah. You yourself have been liberated, and that's how you will act towards other people. So it is. It is liberating. It gives liberation to us personally, and it's an invitation for us to do the same for others.
Yeah.
I have heard it said that just as the verse one is the crucial introduction to this passage, so is the phrase, as he has loved you, in what Jesus has loved us, is the crucial introduction to understanding the law under Jesus.
Well, we might need to leave Exodus there and move on to Matthew. So before we do, I want to thank you so much, Megan Turton.
Yes, we've gone deep but quick. Yeah, we could be here
a
long time.
Thank you for having me, and all the best with continuing the discussion.
Well, and all the best, Megan, with your editing, because we know you're taking precious time away from the final stages of your PhD, so we very much appreciate
it. We're very grateful. Thanks, Megan.
I feel refreshed from it already. Bye, everyone.
Bye. Thank you. So, Fran, let's make some connections and turn now to Matthew 21.
Yes, let's.
It just occurs to me when we think of the Decalogue and the New Testament again, one of the other points of connection for me is the Lord's Prayer, you know, with the hallowed be your name, which is such a weird thing to say in English, holy,
made holy. But it's there in the Decalogue.
But it's there about not taking the Lord's name in vain. It's not necessarily about, you know, swearing or some of the ways that I'm not saying you should use God or Jesus' name lightly, but it's about respect for the divine name. Which, you know, it's profoundly Jewish then again when Jesus says this is how you pray, that the name of God is holy.
You know. And it's also about no idols as well, that one, you know,
yes.
That one line.
So Matthew 21, we have a difficult parable.
Look, we do, and I must admit perhaps in parish context, I'm a bit sick of these parables by now in Matthew.
Okay.
I might say.
So another reason to preach on the Decalogue in Exodus.
Well, I do think if the Decalogue's there, folks, you should perhaps, for all the reasons we've just outlined culturally around what law, we assume law to mean, and the absence of grace in law and so on, perhaps preach on that passage. But, however, we will give this one some attention. So
we will.
Is a rendition or not replication exactly, but in Isaiah 5 of a vineyard parable. Correct me when I start to say inaccurate.
No.
So from about verse 1 to 6 or 7 in Isaiah chapter 5. But it's been recast or rechanged here by Jesus or by Matthew in Jesus' mouth. So in the Isaiah passage, I believe it's about the failure of the vineyard to produce, whereas this is about the tenants, i.e. the religious authorities, and how they are stewarding over the vineyard.
Yes, and in Isaiah 2, it's worth saying that the response of God is to then just destroy the vineyard. But in this Matthew parable, the vineyard is not destroyed, the tenants are replaced. But
and that's super important for another theological reason we'll talk about in a few minutes. so we mentioned Ben Myers' rules for preaching parables a couple of times in the past about, you know, not crudely making certain characters in the story God or us or so on. But I do wonder whether in this one it's pretty clear that we can do that, or that the teller of the parable wishes us to do that, so that the landowner is God, the vineyard is Israel, the slaves are the prophets that were sent to Israel that were not listened to and beaten and destroyed. And that this parable, so it's a recasting of the Isaiah one, but it's not so much about the vineyard failing to produce, but also about the son, the killing of the son, so which obviously is intended to be Jesus in this story. So it's sort of a bit outlandish, if I might say, or unrealistic. Well, for a start, why if two slaves have been murdered, why would you send your son?
Yeah, two if not three. I mean, in the
three, yeah.
Yeah, so in the first scenario, you've got, you know, the slaves are beaten, killed and stoned. What the distinction is between killed and stoned might simply be the means of death, because stoning. Yeah. You know, and then you've got the same result the second time. And so you're right. This is what, so Amy Jill Levine, who's a Jewish American New Testament scholar at Vanderbilt, she does a lot of work on parables, and she said, you know, we need to be aware of where there are weird twists and things. Mm. And one of them in this parable for me is like, what landowner in his right mind, having had two sets of slaves killed, would send his son and think, oh, they'll respect him? I mean, it's absurd behaviour. It's just stupid.
I did read somewhere that in an honour shame culture that would make some sense, but I'm not convinced it does. I mean, you know, you would protect your own, surely, anyway.
Because I think in the context in Matthew, that is the twist. That is the absurdity of God sending Jesus. If we go with this, and I agree with what you just said. I think generally we should resist just allegorizing parables, but this is probably one that it makes most sense to do that. Mm. And Jesus himself suggests in the narrative, as Matthew has it, that, you know, an allegorical kind of meaning in this setting.
Mm. So I suppose I don't want to, perhaps I won't leap that far ahead. We should probably mention verse 42, which is a very explicit highlighting of Jesus as the Son and who is rejected and then becomes the cornerstone, and this was Lord's doing, and it's an amazing in our eyes, and that's a reference to Psalm 118, I think.
Yeah, yep.
Go.
Yep. No, well, I was just going to say I think the problem I want to name in this parable, you know, so everything we've said is, you know, right, and it is about the uniqueness of Jesus and the radical strangeness of a God who would send his own son into a situation of danger and conflict. In a sense, if we give it the most generous reading, to reclaim what is his, or to take, you know, with a potentially a sense of benevolence, but it could be read differently. But in the context, this is part of a dialogue in the temple between Jesus and the, I think the text says, the scribes and the Pharisees or the Jewish leaders.
Chief priests. This is, it's the third encounter of a challenging kind.
Highly polemical.
And I would suggest if you are going to preach on this week and you haven't already spent some time challenging Christians' tendency to fall into supersessionism, which is the replacement of Israel by the church. That is, supersessionism is arrogantly dismissing the Jewish tradition on which we are built and without which we would not exist. Now, we can do that implicitly by failure to pick out the nuances in passages and aspects of our faith that are directly from Judaism, or we can do it explicitly, which anti-Semitism, which is the root of anti-Semitism. And I suppose I feel if I was looking at this week, I probably would take the opportunity to talk about how it's just so theologically wrong to put the church in the place of Israel.
It totally
pulls apart Jesus' identity. We cannot know who Jesus is if we do that.
No.
So it's theologically wrong. It also, I've been reading and listening a bit to Willie James Jennings, and I've mentioned his book before, The Origins of Race, but he talks about this theological heresy essentially of supersessionism as actually underlying underlying racism and division amongst peoples in the Christian community.
Yeah.
Because what it's done, and this is complicated because it's underlined the colonial movement that had white people invade Australia and everywhere else.
Yeah.
Built into this is this that whiteness, so that, you know, the darker your skin, the less saved you can be and all of that stuff. This is supersessionism, along with that kind of thinking, has meant that we as Christians have completely forgotten that we were and are a marginalised group who have been invited into a faith and into a place before God. Yeah. We've been invited by others, by Jews.
Yes.
And we behave all the time as if we are the hosts.
Yeah. Yep.
And we are the centre, and that's complicated by a whiteness, a European whiteness as well that he goes into. And I can put a link to a shorter lecture he gave at a church in America a couple of years ago if people are interested to get a bit of a broad sweep of his thinking. It's really helpful.
Yes.
And you can really see, if you don't, you know, think, you know, yeah, it's theologically relevant to challenge supersessionism and that's where it ends. It so isn't where it ends. He shows how that theological mistake leads into huge fracturing that we're all living under. Now, in America, it is a bit worse.
Yes, or more obvious.
It's more obvious. So I know I sound like I'm really straying from the text, but I actually don't believe that I am.
No, I agree, because I think this is a text that, read at a surface level, and I think we need to name this problem. We get it in John's gospel very starkly as well, but also here in Matthew, a text that can read as anti-Jewish very clearly. And the minute we stop talking about Jesus as a Jew in the temple, engaging in Jewish debate that is highly polemical here, and we forget to maybe think about Matthew's context where, again, there's probably some antagonism, as much as we know about the social situation, might be reflecting conflict between Matthew's community and Jews who did not accept Jesus as Messiah. If we naively repeat that rhetoric and the text itself, we are, you know, engaging in an anti-Jewish speech that leads to all the things you're naming. And Amy Jill Levine, whose work I mentioned before in Parables, has a little book called The Misunderstood Jew, which I've been reading with one of my classes this semester. And she traces the same thing, that when the Christian church has divorced itself from Judaism, it's usually because of this European centering of whiteness that, you know, has not just, and I use the word just not lightly, it has obviously led to huge anti-Semitism, and we've seen the effects of that in human history, but it also leads to other racist and colonialising tendencies. So
yeah, and Willie goes into how it's also removing identity from the earth, from geography. So he talks about wanting to create a grounded community.
Yeah.
He also, and I should say, when he talks about whiteness, it's not something you are born like racially or in your gender, or it's something you are formed into, and it's a lack of humility. It's having the power to remain at the centre and control things and see yourself doing that. And built into it is a vested interest in being ignorant or thinking you're invisible doing it.
Yes.
So anyway.
Keeping the status quo.
Yeah. So that is perhaps straying a little from the text. But
Let's take it back to the text, Fran. How then do you preach this in a way that is preaching the good news but not doing all those things that we've named? How do we talk about this is a parable Jesus told that, you know, was good news for some people?
Well, I mean, I think one of the things that you alluded to at the beginning was that sort of in the Isaiah account of this vineyard parable, the vineyard is destroyed, and here it isn't.
Yeah.
It isn't destroyed. There's actually no faith, there's no judgment in the story around which faith group has got it right or wrong, really.
Yes.
And I think it's reiterating what Matthew's done before, which I think we mentioned in last week's parable too, which is those who may enter the kingdom and live in it fully are those whose behaviour matches what they believe, you know.
Yep.
What they say, you know, that they believe Jesus is the Son of God and it comes mercifully, and that if you act in that fashion, you are a member of the kingdom, and there's not a distinction here between Jews and Christians who do that. It's just whoever does it.
Yeah. Yep.
So I think that's a really important point to identify here that is good news.
Yes, I agree.
But, I mean, you know, there is judgment here.
There is judgment, and we're going to get more in Matthew.
Yeah, chapter verse 44.
Yeah.
And
it also functions in the text to explain Jesus' death too. I mean, we get this ominous note at the end of chapter 21 about, you know, the Pharisees and chief priests know that Jesus is talking about them, and they tried to arrest him, but they're afraid of the crowds. I mean,
the crowds again and again.
Yeah, that's right. So the crowds play a role, but also this is about building conflict in the text that sort of shows why Jesus ends up sort of rejected by his own.
I suppose that, I mean, the good news is that the landowner keeps sending. Yeah. I mean, you know, there is a faithful, we talk about, you know, this God whom we worship, the God of the Hebrew scriptures in the New Testament, is the God who keeps coming back and keeps re-speaking after he's been rebuked or ignored
or rejected.
So God is as God is here all the time.
Yes. You know? Even to the extent, if we take the Son, you know, image, even to the extent of sending something of his own that is so profoundly precious, knowing there is risk in doing so.
That for me is the good news here.
Yeah, I agree.
Along with those other points we've made narratively about the church in Israel as they're represented here.
Yeah. Well, I think on that note, we better wind up because we've gone long. Thank you for listening. This podcast has been brought to you by the Uniting Church in Australia and Pilgrim Theological College.
Thanks, folks.